Okay, just recapping what we saw last time to see, to be able to understand in gravity what is going differently. So we're working in this situation where we are considering sigmas without boundaries to simplify things. Now, the big picture is the following. We've worked so far most of the time in M covariantly, so in spacetime, and we have a space of a covariant phase space, which is F is the space of off-shell history, so all configurations of fields over spacetime independently of whether they satisfy the equations of motion or not. Then certain results were only holding on shell, as in particular Noether theorems and so on. So it was important to impose equations of motion and look at the on-shell phase space also covariantly. And we argued that this guy should be closely related to the usual phase space, the physical phase space of the theory. So to make this correspondence, what we did was to restrict our fields to a Cauchy surface sigma. And what we found was this surprise that in the presence of gauge symmetries, depending on which space one started from, one can end up on two different phase spaces, canonical phase spaces. So what is the difference between the two, and what is the importance of the two? So the off-shell one is the one that is mostly used because it's local. It's just, for example, in Young-Mills, we will see it's just the connection and electric fields. And to obtain it, one just takes the field, the covariant fields, and restricts them to the boundary. So one has to usually do two things, restrict the fields, and also look at the normal derivative of these fields and treat them as independent fields with respect to the surface. So normal derivatives are not functions of the tangent values of the field, so to say. So these are really new field from the perspective of sigma. Sometimes it's not just the normal derivative, but there are extra decorations here. Like in Young-Mills and also gravity. But they can be reabsorbed in a unique redefinition of what this momentum is. So over here, but yeah, so in the presence of gauge symmetries, this data, if we want to be on shell, if we want these to be initial conditions for our equations of motion, are not free. We cannot choose them as we please, point by point in over sigma. So this is the meaning of constraints. And we saw, and we are going to review it right now, that there is an interplay between constraint and gauge symmetries, which means that these reduced phase space or physical phase space, which is where all the physical degree of freedom actually sits, not only have to satisfy the constraint, but one also has to remove the gauge part of these degrees of freedom to make these into an actual phase space. So this modding out of the gauge together with the constraints usually introduces some non-localities, and that's why it's much easier to work over here as far as possible and impose them maybe only at the end. Impose the constraints and the gauge reduction only at the end. So in Young-Mills, what happens? Are there questions about this big picture? Anything? So in Young-Mills, we have connections valued in the Lie algebra over spacetime. We worked out this omega many times. And then we saw that to go on the off-shell phase space, what one does is to pull back our connection to the boundary. Doing so, one loses the normal part of the connection. So that's why I'm changing symbol, because A0 is not part of this guy, for example. But it's part of these decorations that change what the electric field is. And if one looks at this formula for the electric field, which is, oh, here I miss a star, sorry. This is a Hodge dual of F. So it's basically this guy over here pulled back to my surface. And this is, in fact, the normal derivative of this little a plus things, which are there to make it gauge covariant. So So this brings us to the off-shell phase space with the electric field and the connection and the gauge potential on the surface. Now, well, here I don't have much to say. We have the equations of motion, which are what they are. But so what is the connection between the relationship between the off-shell and the reduced phase space? To do so, to understand this, one has to understand what the constraint is in this theory. This is the Gauss constraint, which is the divergence of E, the 3D divergence of E, or if you want, is the pullback of this equation to the surface. So the details are not too important, but it's worth recognizing that the constraint is the part of the equations of motion that when written in terms of A and E, so the canonical variables over here, contain no time derivative. So they're really constraints on the initial data. Now we want to see what's the relation between this constraint and gauge is. Well, to see this, one has to look at the Hamiltonian flow equation for our symmetries. And this is how we wrote it in spacetime in F. But if we pull it back to our Cauchy surface and we express things in terms of the canonical variable, what we find is a very similar equation with a slightly different flavor, but is very similar. And we find that gauge transformations are generated by the Gauss constraint. So the Hamiltonian function for the gauge flow is the Gauss constraint. This is a very, this is well known, and usually one says that constraints generate gauge transformations. Now, the point is, if we go on shell of our constraints, that is zero, which means that gauge transformation are in the kernel of our symplectic structure on shell, not everywhere, but on shell. So it means that our symplectic structure now has some degenerate directions if we go on shell of the constraints. And to take care of that, we have to either quotient or gauge fix our gauge freedom. So this is why the two goes always end in end. And we saw how to do this for the parameterized particle during the first tutorial. So I'm not too interested in mathematizing this step, but it's just important to keep in mind that imposing the constraint and gauge fixing are two sides of the same medal. Like there is this one step that requires two independent actions. So now we want to do the same for gravity. And the main difference is that what will happen to normal diffeomorphisms is that this equation will not hold. So we will lose the simple interpretation of what the constraints are and do. And this is what we want to understand. So in general, any questions about the big picture? So in GR, we saw that eta sigma can be written as, so here I'm again in F. Let me write it in F first. Theta sigma is the integral over sigma of, and I claim this, we didn't prove it, but minus 2d sigma square root of a, k, minus, and here we found that there was also a boundary term where this b, it's not important to write this down, but I just write it for reference to see that it has an easy explicit, square root of gamma of the metric on. So what we said is that in any case, we don't care about this because we work without boundaries. And this guy is the York term, York, Gibbons, Hawkins, and it's a total variation. So it will not enter our omega, so we can forget about it. Now, the interest of this formula is that this k is essentially, as promised, up to a factor of 2. Just the normal derivative of our field, like the analogous of that little phi, which is the metric induced on the surface. So this entire block over here will be our momentum. We call this our Legendre transform. Tells us that pi ij is equal to kappa. Oh, I should have put the square root of h here, which I didn't. So these are always densities in field theories. So one talks about a tensor density of weight 1. It means that there is a power of 1 of the square root of h multiplied by a tensor. This is important because under a diffeomorphism, square root of h transforms with the divergence of the vector field. So one has to remember this. One has to be fooled that this has two upper indices and say, oh, this is transforms like a tensor. No, it transforms like a tensor density of weight 1. There is, one has to remember this piece. So this is our momentum. It's called the ADM momentum. And the point is that on M, what I get is our off shell or ADM. So this is the same as the off shell from before.
Just this word, yeah. ADM has come up so often.
ADM is Arnovit, Deser, Misner. There are three guys who formalized like the Hamiltonian analysis of general relativity in the modern form. Many people tried before, and it was always kind of, there were moving parts. They set, like, they found the right variables and wrote down all the things in the ways that are found in books. It's a paper, like the original paper has 1,000 citations, it's classic. But in any book of GR, there is, you find the
formalism. It's not just ADM, but let's say
it. Yeah. It's a whole huge package. Essentially, the way people call the Hamiltonian formulation of GR is usually written in terms of the three metric and this momentum or the extrinsic curvature. As you can see, they are closely related. That's what is called the ADM formula. When you use h and pi as your fundamental variables, and you do the Hamiltonian analysis. So this one is already the fact that in GR there are famous people giving names to these things that in Young Mills are so basic should be a warning that things are actually quite more complicated in this theory. So what did I want to? Oh, yeah. So this is delta pi j, delta hij. So as you can see, there is no square root of h here because it's contained automatically in this pi. And whereas in a scalar field theory, it doesn't really matter if I put it in or out because it's not part of my field space, in gravity is important that I vary it as well, so it should be inside. Okay. So with this, we can go and look at the constraints. So the constraints, maybe this. I erase this since we don't need this guy. Okay.
Question.
Yes.
Is it ever useful to view this momenta as like the Hodge star of something, like a 3 Hodge star or something?
It will.
Or is that just unnecessary? necessarily complex.
Well, here we're not using differential form, so there's no odd star. If we use the variables that we started exploring in the tutorial last week, then this will look much more like Young Mills and will be this odd star of, well, the pullback of the odd star of some. So, and it will be important. We will go through the, we will finish the tutorial this Friday, so we will see exactly where. Okay, so the constraints. The constraints, if you remember, are the normal part of the Noether current. So we can go back and look in our notes what the Noether current was, and what we find is that, so in fact, they're not just these, they are the bulk part of these. Sorry. So let me write it a little better, sorry. So let's say Q sigma psi is the integral of Na GAB square root Na GAB psi b, plus, if you remember, the boundary term that we used was this comma term, but again, here we're not interested in it, so we put it to this was interesting because it contained the angular momentum charge and so on, because this will vanish on shell. So this is what matters for the charges. But as far as the constraints go and the symmetry of the theory go, this is the piece that we're interested in studying. So it turns out that this normal component of GAB, a bit like the pullback of the star of F, do not only depend on H and pi and not on their normal derivatives. So they are actually the constraints. But we have two different parts of these, which have very different forms. So one is GNN, and the other is GNI, the parallel part. So what we need to do to really analyze this is to break this psi into a normal diffeomorphism and the tangential one. So these are our constraints. There are four of them, one per component of psi. To further analyze them, we need to decompose psi, and we write it as x plus n, little n. So this is the normal diffeo, normal to sigma, and this is the part which is parallel to sigma. Okay. So So there are some formulas of, these are classical formula in differential geometry, Riemannian geometry, that go back to I think the 19th century, most of them, or maybe the early 20th, which are called the Gauss-Kodazzi formulas or Gauss-Kodazzi-Meinardi, and exactly what they tell you. They express the four-dimensional, certain components of the four-dimensional Riemann tensor in terms of the three-dimensional one and the extrinsic curvature. So intrinsic curvature and extrinsic curvature encode almost completely the, the four-dimensional curvature. So certainly certain components, other components are in a sense gauge dependent. That's the problem. But for what we need for the constraints, using these Gauss-Kodazzi formulas, what one finds is that I defined the vector constraint as the one associated to my tangent part. And this is sigma. So I put a bar to say that this is a three-dimensional covariant derivative with respect to h, not g. So a couple of comments about this formula. First of all, this is a tensor density. So this is not just the covariant derivative in as one would guess it from the index structure. There is an extra term due to the presence of the determinant, which is a divergence of the vector field symbol, like a trace of the Christoffel symbol. So one has to remember this, that this is a tensor density. But in case you're interested in doing some computations and verify some formulas, that you need to remember this fact. And that's why there is no square root of h in front of this, because it's basically contained in pi. So as you can see, this guy, this vector constraint, pretty much looks like a Gauss constraint. It's the divergence of the momentum. And in fact, in everything, it works the same way as long as there are no boundaries of sigmas. This guy will work, the vector constraint will work as a pH constraint in Young-Mills. So no major problems. Then we have a scalar or Hamiltonian constraint, which is the one associated to the to the normal part of our vector field. And this one has a very complicated form, in fact. So of course, it multiplies n as much as this one multiplies x. Then we wrote this last time, but now I want to stop a second and give some pi square minus 1 over 2 square root of h. So this is the 3D Ricci scalar. And if we have a cosmological constant, there will be lambda. So this term multiplies n. It's easy to see that it is a spatial scalar. It's a 3D. It looks a bit like the, in fact, it's the same structure as the Einstein action, but on the Cauchy surface. And it works a bit like a potential. So this is like a potential term because it's only a function of h. If we think of this as a particle Hamiltonian, we have momentum square plus potential. This is like, this is the potential. Well, b maybe is not the best choice, but it's a function of h only. This is the kinetical term, in quotes. Because it's the square of the momenta. Now, you might have heard about the De Witt supermetric is the essentially the metric that is hiding behind here when you take the square of pi. You can write it as the square of pi with respect to a certain metric on field space, and this metric is the De Witt metric. So this is just a side note. It's not, I will not use it, so I will not write it down. Now, let's look at why there is this square root of 1 over square root of h here. So exactly. So this is density 1. This is density 2. I have to remove 1. So this is why it's here. The metric is also hiding in this contraction of indices, both inside here and inside here. This contains inverse powers of the like inverse metrics, because to compute the Christoffel symbol that I need to compute r, I need h to the minus. So can you imagine taking, like, trying to quantize a guy like this? It's absolutely horrible, right? So in fact, this is a non-polynomial function of my fields. It's a complete it's a complete nightmare. So this is where next time we will see that the hashtag R variables actually simplify things enormously. But so this is the Hamiltonian, and formally the equation that H equal to zero classically is the Hamiltonian constraint. Quantum mechanically would be the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. So this is its origin, and so one replaces this pi with functional derivative with respect to H. It's like a Schrodinger quantization of this would be the Wheeler-DeWitt equation.
Good question. Mm-hmm. Do things get like a lot simpler if you go to linearized gravity, or does it stay pretty complicated?
No, it simplifies greatly. I'm not sure what forms it takes precisely, but it does. But I suspect that there are still some subtle issues. I'm not familiar with linearized gravity. It does simplify. Okay. So now we want to understand what's the relation between these constraints and our symmetries. Now that we have them, that's the next step. So like Hamiltonian properties. By Hamiltonian properties, I mean with respect to that sort of Hamiltonian equation. So remember, in F, we had an equation like this. Except that it didn't stop here. We had two extra terms, plus a term that we're setting to zero because it was a term on partial sigma. So that we're throwing out. We cared about it last time. This time, we focus on this one. So as long as we want to stay here to have everything local and nice, we cannot really dismiss this term. So now when we go on in the IDM phase space, the off-shell phase space of general relativity in this 3+1 formalism, what we need to do, again, we need to treat this size differently. There is the tangent one and the normal one. Here it's clear that the two have different properties because the normal one, this term for the tangent one, this term identically vanishes independently of E, simply because you look at the index structure of this, and if you contract it with something tangent, it's zero on the surface. This is proportional to the normal part of this psi. So in that case, we have two different equations, one for x, which just says that this is v of x, and there's nothing else to be said there, and this is one finds this plus n e. Now, this creates problems for various reasons. So as we can see, this works basically like Young-Mills. Like a Young-Mills gauge theory, and it's the nicest possible equation. So what is the problem with this one? So first of all, it's non-zero on p off, and okay, but it gets worse because this term depends on in fact cannot be written in terms of pi and h only. So it's not even, this equation is not even completely correct. It's not really in p. So this has to be taken I'm saying if we try, this is what we would get, but it doesn't work because of this term. So we really have an issue. So we need to find another way to understand what's happening with this guy. This equation is not good enough. It's causing us problems. So it cannot be written on P. We tried, we failed. So what should we do? So this is a result by, if you want to read more about it, Leewald, 1991. They do what I did with a slightly different angle, but most of what I said is inspired from them. So I tried to argue last time. Is there any question up at this point? Because I'm kind of changing here a little bit. So, yes.
I just want to make sure I understand. So I understand the Hamiltonian constraint is very complicated.
Yeah.
But is the real? But I could imagine it's very complicated, but still in principle you could quantize it.
Mm-hmm.
Is this?
This is
the
a
real issue. Like the.
There are two real issues.
Real issue.
Yeah. This is more real than that. So this is. Maybe finding different variables, we can solve this. There's no way to solve this one by finding new variables. This is if we look at the origin of this term, is really general covariance. There's nothing else going into the presence of this term. It doesn't really matter which shape the equations of motion take, what theorem looking at. If it is a general covariant theory, this term will be there, and this obstruction will be there. So. This tells me immediately that this cannot be Hamiltonian off-shell. But here it gets even worse because it just cannot be written this equation cannot be written on the phase space. And this is not proven for other variables here, but I suspect that the argument can be. It's completely variable independent, I suspect, because if you understand the geometry of why this is happening, it's quite clear. So this next problem, in a sense, is more fundamental than how complicated this guy is. Here we are not even looking at that H explicitly. So yeah, this is a deeper problem. And we will see what it means now. I mean, hopefully by the end of today or at worst, Thursday. So. To understand these constraints, you remember, we want to impose them. We want to say that on P, we want to set them to zero. To set them to zero consistently, we need that their Poisson brackets vanishes as well. So to consistently set constraints to zero on P off, we need the bracket between two constraints, let's call them, I don't know, A and B. Doesn't really, here is just abstract thinking. It should be proportional to another constraint. So actually, let's call this psi theta. So here we need something. And I say it's proportional to these so that also this one, not just C, vanishes when the constraint vanishes by definition, but also their bracket has to vanish. So if you think quantum mechanically, I cannot impose the C equals 0 if the bracket of two Cs is non-zero. Maybe it's 1, so it would be completely inconsistent. And here is the same thing classically. So. I need this to happen. And now, and here is where the fact that that's very complicated makes it difficult, because you can have all sorts of operator ordering ambiguities when you try to quantize this. But this is kind of a side issue. So now what we need to look at is our classical algebra of these V and H constraints. So it's not obvious by looking at this equation that that the VH algebra will be nice. The V algebra will be nice because it satisfies the usual equation, but H, it's not clear. So we need to go and check. And if we do, we find the following. This is expected. This is what we expect from this equation over here. This is the lead derivative of x with respect to y. Or vice versa, of y with respect to x is anti-symmetric. Then, and if you want dually, it's saying that v is a vector. It is something valued in covectors, if you want, so that it nicely contracts covariantly. Because, yeah. So then we take v with h, and we find that this is h. So this guy behaves like a scalar. This is what it's telling me, that if my vector field just derives n as if it was a scalar. So if you want, let's remember that this is just, so no metric is involved. This is absolutely fine. And it's essentially telling me that h, so that this square bracket over here is a density of weight 1. So that I can integrate it against a scalar and find something that is it's a scalar, in fact. So when you apply a diffeomorphism, tangential diffeomorphism, everything works fine. And now, finally, we need to look at what happens to this guy. So HH will give me V of something. I call it Z, and I say what Z is outside here. So this is Hij ndjm mdjn. So it's a vector constraint, not an Hamiltonian one, but this is a vector constraint. So this closes, and we are happy. But the catch is that this depends on my metric. So it depends which vector field pops out here on the right-hand side depends on where I am on phase space. So it means that, so there are various consequences of these. First consequence is the algebra closes. The Poisson algebra, the constraint algebra closes. Constraint algebra. So by this, one means that star is satisfied, where star is this one. So, and this algebra is called the hypersurface deformation algebra for reasons we will explore in a second. In fact, call it Dirac's hypersurface deformation algebra. The problem is that it's not really an algebra because it depends on these are like the structure constants, right? So here, if this was Yang-Mills, this would be Fijk or epsilon in SU2. So it's a constant. This one is not a constant. So it's not really a representation of the Lie algebra that we're finding. And this is related to the second point.
So they're not really structure constants. Hmm? So they're not really structure
constants. No, because they depend on the phase space point. And that's a huge source of complication, but it's also crucial for the geometry. So it's not a noise, it's not a nuisance, it's a feature, a complicated feature to deal with, but it's a feature. Two, it's precisely this point that the constraint algebra is not a representation of the 4D diffeomorphisms. And here 4D is what where the accent is. Tangential diffeomorphisms are represented on right by V. So here, note 3D diffeos are represented by the Vs, by the vector constraints. Those are represented on right, just like in Young-Mills. The Poisson bracket of two vector constraints gives me the vector constraint of the bracket. So this is what I mean by representation. It's not the case for the last piece, the remaining diffeomorphism. And already we see that we're not talking about the last direction of the diffeomorphism as if it was a vector field, but more like a scalar, because we have this fixed normal that we use to translate and decompose. So, and in this translation and decomposition, something gets lost, gets reshuffled. And this is the point. And three, we do not have structure constants, but structure functions. Like normal diffeos involve, in quotes, structure functions. By this is just an informal way of saying that this depends on the metric. This is this statement over here.
Is that your terminology, structure functions? Or?
No, it's quite common. It's not me inventing it, but it's still a bit. It just means that instead of having structure constants, which are independent of where you are in phase space, they are structure functions on phase space. But it's not a mathematic. I would say it's not a mathematic. But it's still, it's very common. It's used in the literature. So this makes it very hard to quantize because you're not dealing with an abstract algebra, but something that depends on where you are in phase space, and phase space has a complicated structure. So it's a bit of a nightmare. And sometimes, in fact, I would say it's not even completely clear mathematically what is the abstract mathematical structure that is best to use to understand this thing. It's not a Lie algebraoid, which is the easiest case of a structure of structure functions. It's more complicated than that. So what I just want to say is that this is pretty unusual in the mathematical literature as a structure, because it comes out of GR, but not so much naturally from other places. So it's a very
I was just trying to understand, like, if we had like a Euclidean instead,
mm-hmm.
Do we run into the same issues with the split, or is this like
very good
Lorentzian or something?
No, but it's a very good question. So what happened if my fourth direction was Euclidean as well? So, or I'm interested in a Euclidean, a radial evolution, which is along a Euclidean direction. So what happens, in fact, the last, this radial direction in a Lorentzian space, I'm not so sure what changes. But for a Euclidean geometry, fully Euclidean, I don't want to say it wrong, but I think is the sign of these that changes, and that's it. So in fact, I'm sure that there is one sign that changes, and I think the only one that it makes sense is this one. So the point is that from this algebra, you can even read the signature of spacetime. So my signs could be wrong. There could be some minuses. So maybe what I wrote is the Euclidean version. I forgot to double check, but what changes in Euclidean signature is a sign here. And this is a nice point, because it's a good introduction to what I want to say next. So what I want to go towards, what I want to argue, is that this hypersurface deformation algebra, in fact, is encoding the existence of a four-dimensional spacetime behind my 3D phase space. So let's move slowly towards this statement to try to understand what I actually mean. So to understand this algebra, one has to first step backwards a second. So away from GR for a second. So why is called Dirac's hypersurface deformation algebra? Because it was Dirac who first found it out. But he wasn't studying GR itself. He was warming up for GR. So he found it by studying parametrized field theories. So, and I think the place where this is written is the lectures on quantum mechanics, which is kind of confusing because this is about, it's a geometric result. But he was trying to formulate field theory in a manifestly foliation independent way. But let me write it. So Dirac discovered the hypersurface deformation algebra by studying parametrized I think scalar field theory, but it's not really important. And here there are the two important things. On a Minkowski background, but on an arbitrary foliation thereof. So what are the important words? The main important, the words are here parameterized and the fact that there was a background. But an arbitrary foliation. So parametrized field theory, you remember what we did with the particle? We wrote the particle in flat, the action for the particle in flat space, but we wrote it in a way that made it coordinate independent. So we used this word line theory, but what was important is that the parameter along that word line was not time, it was just a parameter. So you can play the same trick on a Minkowski background for a field theory. So it's really not so much more than the parameterized particle, but done for a field theory. So it's the next step in the exercise ladder. So you take your coordinates of spacetime and you make them arbitrary, but and you still want to describe the Ethereum Minkowski space. It doesn't really matter what background you're in. But this allows you to study changes of hypersurfaces. So you want to describe an evolution with respect to an arbitrary foliation, not the rigid Minkowski usual foliation. So this is what Dirac was doing back then. And what he discovered was that he found out that there were generators for spatial diffeos, normal diffeos, in a sense, like the analog of this V and H, which closed in this way. But there, this H was a background H, was not part of field space. So in his case, in Dirac's case, field space was given by was a scalar field theory, and Hij, Kij were background objects. Oops. software background. What do I mean by background? Data variation vanishes. So the V was a, I don't know which form it was taking precisely, but it's kind of is the analog for of a translation generator, except that it was generating translation at each point differently. So I suspect these would be some components of the stress energy tensor. Now I don't remember the formula, but so in this case, V of X is more like a generator of local translations, and H of normal evolution. And they satisfy the same algebra. They satisfy this hypersurface deformation algebra. So in that case, these were structure functions which are dependent on the foliation and the background. But now there is a change of gear. So here you see the space-time behind is given. In gravity, if you're working in the 3 plus 1 mindset, you have a 3D geometry and the momentum for this 3D geometry, which you actually don't even know what that is geometrically. It's just a canonical momentum. And so there's no background space-time that you're looking at. So where does this space-time come from in the Hamiltonian description? So the point I'm trying to make is that this is quite intuitive, but this is not the right way of thinking about that algebra in GR. So now, in GR, we do not have a background space-time. In fact, on PADM, we do not even have an a priori geometrical meaning or pi. What I mean by this, it's easier to say in words than to write it down, is the fact that if I have just my sigma and a metric on sigma, I can say I have a conjugate momentum. But if I do not have a space-time in which this sigma is embedded, there's no meaning of talking about extrinsic curvature and things like that. So this pi is just an abstract momentum. So if I want to really take seriously this 3 plus 1 formulation of general relativity, which is called geometrodynamics, which was sponsored by Wheeler in particular, was the biggest proponent of this, the one who invented this stuff. And then you really need to switch gears in your head and try to think from the sigma perspective, forgetting about space. And the magic is that then, if you try to implement this algebra, which is just, as I said, just a priori telling you how to deform these foliations in space-time, but you don't know it a priori, if you try to implement it, what you find out is that only on shell of V and H equal to 0, with them satisfying this algebra, you can reconstruct the space-time out of the variables you have consistently. So here in GR, in In fact, I don't even want to say GR. I should say in geometrodynamics, which is this 3 plus 1 way of thinking about GR. If you want 3 plus 1 GR. But this is a bit simplistic, because what I really mean is this change of mental framework in which I think about things. In geometrodynamics, imposing B equals 0 and H equals 0 and the validity, well, it comes out naturally because we know that that's an algebra, but in a sense, the equals 0. Sorry, I should say it slightly differently. There is a stronger result that I can describe. In geometrodynamics, the only way to, in quote, represent the hypersurface deformation algebra, which I mean finding functions for which V and H satisfy that algebra. And see, now it's crucial that this H is there, because it makes things much more rigid, much more constrained, because it's now a function on phase space, is to set V equals 0 and H equals 0. So if they do not vanish, you cannot impose that consistently. And from these, one deduces the existence, well, I don't know if the existence is really the right word, but one can reconstruct a four-dimensional space-time. But let me write it. Of a four-dimensional space-time out of the canonical data. And I want to, well, I wanted to give the main point of this statement, and I say it in words. So these brackets, the last bracket, the main one, the one that controls everything, is, think of it as a commutator. It's the easiest way to think of it as a commutator. The Jacobi equation would actually do the same in the classical theory, but let's think of it as a commutator. What does it mean to take the bracket? It means applying one first and then the other. So if I have a function on my field space, and it means that first I evolve it by this amount in the normal direction, whatever that is, and then by this other amount in the normal direction, or I do the opposite. Now, these two evolutions do not need to agree. They can differ. Where you arrive is two points on the same hypersurface, but translated by this constraint, by a diffeo, by this diffeo. So this, you find it. It's a complicated. It's not easy to see, but you can find it just by saying I have a spacetime and I have a foliation, and I study how the foliations evolve, and I find this equation. Now, here I'm reverse engineering that. I'm saying that these two evolutions give this evolution only if behind there is secretly a space-time which is foliated differently. So what I'm trying to say is that, and it's not very easy to phrase in a short statement, I find. But is that the fact that if you evolve your theory in normal directions by two different parameters and you find this diffeomorphism is the signature of the fact that behind the evolution, there is an actual space-time, an actual four-dimensional geometry which you are foliating. But from an Hamiltonian picture, we are evolving an abstract three geometry. There is no need for it to be related to a four-dimensional space-time behind. You can just say my three geometry does what it wants, and it doesn't need to come from slicing a four-dimensional. Just a second. But crucially, in GR, what is happening is that these parentheses depends on the metric itself. And now, to make these dependence self-consistent, that's why you need to impose V and H equal to zero. They cannot take other values. And this is due to this dependence. So there's no other way of representing things consistently except than setting them to zero. So this algebra is all you need to know to be able to say, to reconstruct general relativity, first of all, because this only works on shell of the Einstein's equation, not other equations. And in fact, and it tells you, and it's telling you that this 3 plus 1 picture is not some random 3 plus 1 picture, is the one that tells you that underneath, behind, secretly, there is a four-dimensional spacetime. The history is consistent with the existence of a four-dimensional spacetime. So maybe I'll come back to these more slowly next time. But the paper that explains this really well is by, I will upload it actually. It's by Teitelbaum in 73, and another one is in 76 by him, Kajman and Kukash. And they're very beautiful papers to read about the geometry of this algebra. And they have one less important result, which says that if you want to write this algebra on the ADM phase space, then there is a unique way to do it, and are those formulas over there. So they can completely reconstruct the potential term, the kinetic term of that complicated Hamiltonian out of this algebra. And this is a bit like the Lovelock theorem that we were talking about. Just out of kinematics of the symmetry structures, you can reconstruct the dynamics. It is a 3 plus 1 version of that. It's a long paper where there are lots of computations, but if you skip the computation and read the conclusion and the introduction, it's beautiful. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, I was going to ask something kind of similar to that. I guess I was just wondering, like, because you said, okay, if I have this algebra, then I can reconstruct a space-time.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm just wondering how much of this depends on the Einstein Lagrangian and how much is just any diff invariant Lagrangian.
Okay. Two things. First thing is, what I mean is that one can interpret this gauge evolution as an evolution with respect to some arbitrary foliation. So this identification of foliating and gauge evolving is what this implementation of the algebra on shell of the constraint is. The second thing is how much this is about GR and not something else. So as I was saying, if you try to implement those algebra, find for which possible functions V and H over of the variables h and pi, I can, which have bracket 1. So I start from that. I have h and pi with bracket 1, and I want to find v and h which satisfy that algebra with mild assumptions, maybe that h is quadratic in pi, stuff like this. Then it's unique. And it's unique possibly up to the signature of the spacetime, I suppose, and the presence of a cosmological constant or not, stuff like this. But it's essentially unique. And this is like the Lovelock theorem we were talking about. If you have a four-dimensional diffeomorphism conserved tensor, then it's the Einstein. And here is the same. This is a reflection of four-dimensional diffeos, but in a weird way. And the fact that it's weird and not an algebra, but this funny thing is actually crucial for that theorem to work in three dimensions. So the fact that those are not, it's not a four-dimensional diffeomorphism algebra, is actually what allows you from that to reconstruct GR and only GR.
And how much of this, because you keep mentioning Lovelock's theorem, like if I impose this algebra not on like a three-dimensional manifold, but on like a d-dimensional manifold?
Yeah, I don't know in higher dimensional.
Okay. Never mind.
But you see, for, you could do it on a scalar, on the space-time of a scalar, on the field space of a scalar field, and then you wouldn't find those results because those results depend on that dependence on of those constant on H. So you can represent this thing on other, on other, I don't know, for in the Dirac case, on this parameterized particle. So it's really special to the fact that you're choosing a field space that just contains H and pi. And if you do that, you just find vacuum GR.